Morning, Council. As you're setting up, I'll call the case. It's A23-1255, Shane Feldhaus et al., appellants versus City of Minnetonka, respondent. Council, as you probably know, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. And when you start your principal arguments, please state your name and the party or parties that you represent. Also, Council for Appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So 15 principal, 5 minutes for rebuttal. The center podium goes up and down as you wish. There's a toggle button that's in the center and kind of low on the podium. So, Council for Appellant, we are ready for you. If you want to take a minute and set up.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. My name is Benjamin Kirk, and I'm here on behalf of Appellants Shane and Sarah Feldhaus. And I'm here to ask this Court to reverse the District Court's grant of summary judgment in favor of the City. The District Court erred in its application of the law to the facts of this case to rule that no taking occurred and that the City was entitled to immunity on the Feldhaus' tort claims. This matter was dismissed on summary judgment, so this Court's review is de novo and must be reversed on any issue of material fact in dispute or if the district court made any errors of law. Also, as to the tort claims, the city bears the burden of proof that it is entitled to immunity. And on appeal from summary judgment, the court must assume that the facts asserted by the non-moving party, the Feldhauses, are true. I also want to note from the outset that I have not found, and the city has not offered, a single case where a reviewing court upheld the dismissal of a physical taking claim on summary judgment. All the cases cited by the parties involve either a reversal on a dispositive motion or a review of post-trial facts of findings of fact. In this case, there's no dispute as to the following critical facts. The Feldhauses own residential real property in Minnetonka, which is adjacent to Huntington Pond. Huntington Pond is a stormwater retention pond within the city's stormwater infrastructure. The Feldhaus' private property was flooded with the city's stormwater from the pond for weeks and months at a time in 2014, 2017, and 2019 because the city's stormwater.
Council, if you don't mind, I just want to stop you for a moment because you're talking about the duration of the flooding. I think in the 3 years, 2014, 2017, 2019, what does the record tell us about how long the Feldhaus house property was actually underwater?
Yes, Your Honor. In the court's order, the court acknowledged that at least in 2019, it was months at a time. I know in 2017, it was similarly months at a time. It did fluctuate.
Well, months. It could be 2 months. Could be 6 months. So help me out there. So is that all we know in the record? It's your record, right? You were obligated to present those facts.
Yes, Your Honor.
So,
In 2019, it was at least through July through November of 2019. I believe in 2017, it was also, the flooding began in May and did not subside until November or December of that year. I think 2014 was a little bit faster, a shorter period of time that the water inundated the property.
And as I recall the record, you have established that there was some immediate damage from the flooding, right? At least in some of those years related to the sprinkler system, some landscaping, and perhaps there are other issues I don't remember.
Correct, yes. Actual damage to sprinkler system, landscaping, large bushes, trees were killed off. Landscaping materials were submerged and had to be removed. The patio and the lawn were completely submerged in water. It's not wet grass. They were underwater. They were unusable.
Right, and I guess what I'm trying to get at is, again, it's actual physical damage. What I'm trying to understand is where your case fits in the continuum of case law that we have on intermittent flooding. I mean, there's no doubt that when a city builds a dam, right, or not a city, it's probably going to be the county or the state, but a dam is built and private property is flooded as a result of that dam, and that's probably a permanent flooding, right, as a result of the dam, that's part of the plan to create a reservoir, that there is a taking in that instance, in part because of the permanency, right? Mm-hmm. We have intermittent flooding cases, too, as you already alluded to, and this case is different. Of course it is, because it's case by case, different from the facts that we see in other intermittent flooding cases. So what I'm trying to understand is what are the qualities, that the evidence that you presented, that suggests that this rises to the level of an intermittent taking that is actually a constitutional taking? Because there are intermittent flooding cases that have not risen to that level.
Okay. So. Yeah, and I would say the actual damage, absolutely. The damage at the time.
Damage
by the flooding.
Time of the flooding. Okay.
And I would say that the way the cases like Loretto have viewed that type of physical taking, though, would be to say that interference, even that submerging of the property, even if there's not physical actual damage from that, if it's the city's water that is coming onto that property and taking it away from the owners, that is interfering with, you know, all three of their rights, their fundamental property rights to use, to possess, and to dispose of the property. As the court Loretto said, physical taking does not just take a single strand from the bundle of property rights. It cuts through the entire bundle, taking a strand.
But if it is a matter of, say, a small corner of a residential lot that is already abutting a pond and the pond level goes up and down, perhaps, you know, a few days, a week, is that sufficient to amount to a constitutional taking? It seems to me you're alleging a bigger taking than that. And so, I'm trying to fit you on a continuum.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. Right. Yeah, absolutely, something bigger than that. We are not talking about a small corner of the property. We are talking about a substantial portion, the majority of my client's backyard. And, of course, that's all relative, depending on the property we're talking about. I mean, if we're talking about a 40-acre tract of land, like you saw in some of these cases, like the Spaeth and Capone cases, I know one of them at least was a 40-acre plot, taking a area the size of a tennis court really isn't that big in relation to the size of the property. But here, this is a residential lot. You know, it's probably a third of an acre, a quarter of an acre. Taking the entire backyard away from these property owners is significant, I think, to on that relative scale. I think anybody would agree that if your backyard is inundated, you lose your ability to use it, and everybody's backyard is a different size, but if you lose what you have, that's a substantial interference with your rights.
So, if you have more to answer, I don't mean to interrupt that answer. I'm trying to figure out what you think the standard of law is for a taking here, and I'm including based on the answer you just gave. So I had understood the argument, the argument from the briefing. I thought that this was like a Spaeth type case. It's a physical occupation, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
And as I read Spaeth, you know what it talks about is even occasional flooding. If it's of, you know, one has to determine whether it's of such frequency, regularity, and permanency as to constitute a taking, mm-hmm. as opposed to just like temporary where you get some like negligence damages or something
right.
like that, right? So frequency, regularity, and permanency is how that was that language that's echoed later by us and Nolan, et cetera. You just talked, and I think you argue you don't get to the diminution of value of the property. Yet you just talked about bundles of rights in Loretto that include disposing of a property, which is all about mm-hmm. the diminution of diminution of value. And I'm trying to figure out, what do you think the taking is here? What is the right? I thought it was a physical occupation, and that we apply Spaeth, and that you actually don't want to go to the disposing of the property, right? Because that would mean that you needed to put in some evidence about change in market value.
Yeah, I believe that it... I think Spaeth says this, that when you, first of all, we are alleging absolutely a physical taking. That is the claim, physical taking. It's not regulatory. It's not nuisance-based. It's that you have taken the property, you've occupied it. But I think Spaeth and Loretto say that when you do that, when you actually have a physical taking, and there's levels of that, you know, permanence, I'll talk about that in a minute, that the right to dispose, this valuation, is really assumed or almost insignificant because you have because it's known and accepted in the law that real property has a value. It has an absolute value to it. And if I'm taking it from you, I'm occupying it, then I have that's assumed that I've damaged you. Loretto is an excellent example of that, where they said these small cable boxes and these cables running across this building. I mean, we're talking on the side, you know, in a New York apartment
Loretto
building.
Loretto doesn't deal with an intermittent physical occupation, right?
Yeah. So that gets to the next issue about this.
That's why I very much struggle with that. And whether you have some, in this particular case with the facts you're presenting, have some obligation to show substantial interference that destroys or lessens value or destroys or abridges the owner's rights.
Mm-hmm. So
that's the definition of substantial interference that both of the parties are asking us to look at. So
right, Your Honor. So and to cross that bridge into the permanence argument, the permanence issue, and the way Spaeth and Loretto have both said it is, and this is, you see this in all these flooding cases, it doesn't have to be always underwater. It's accepted that it can be intermittent. So at the very least, we've got a fact question on whether or not it is in fact permanent. And the permanent means servitude of indefinite duration or inevitably recurring. And we have an expert who is going to testify, so this is a disputed fact issue, to say this is going to absolutely recur. This is not going to go away. The conditions of this neighborhood have changed. The development has changed such that the hard cover has increased. The pond has not been maintained. Now you have a flooding condition that did not exist before, and it's not going to go away. The only thing that can make it go away is to start tearing down houses, remove hardcover, or install this outlet. But unless you do that, this is always going to come back.
So, counsel, speaking just for myself as I look at this, I mean, because I have real questions about your argument about whether this is a permanent physical invasion or whether a threat of future flooding is enough to constitute a taking. But I am struggling with this question because if we don't, and tell me if I'm wrong about that, if we disagree with you on those two things, we still come back to, was there, you know, enough evidence of substantial interference with use of enjoyment of property and diminution of value? Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay.
At least those, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, and you've just kind of gone through, I want to ask you what you're asking us to do. Let's start with the substantial interference with use and enjoyment. Are you saying, look, we have enough factual issues here that, you know, the 3 times, 10 years, months at a time, that at least should go, we should send it back to a jury determination on that issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
And on the diminution of value issue?
I think that could be part of a jury inquiry, but ultimately if they find a physical taking, I don't think that is for the court to say.
Isn't that true that it's only if they find a permanent physical taking? Wouldn't this be more like the airport noise cases? I mean, which you cite a lot in your brief.
I think this is distinct from those cases because there was not a physical invasion of property in those cases. It's noise. It's offending sensibilities. It's offensive. It's more about the use and enjoyment bundle of sticks, and to decide, you know, is that offensive enough? You have to have something to measure it against, which in those cases was diminution of value.
So you're just saying substantial interference is enough. Okay.
Are you even making a substantial? This is, like, very helpful, this conversation, because I'm trying to pinpoint what you're taking is and what line of cases then we follow because of it. I understand, and I was confused, I think maybe, but it might not be your fault, it might be mine, in reading the briefing. If you say it's a physical taking, it's Spaeth, and I think, although you, and I want to hear from you about this, even though we talk about, Spaeth talks about frequency, regularity, and permanency, you seem to have some objection to looking at frequency, and I wanted to hear about that because it seems to be in there, the case. But this is not, as I understand it, an interference with the use of property a la airport noise cases, right?
Correct.
Okay, so you're not trying to make a substantial interference with use argument, are you or are you? I could see your argument being physical occupation that's intermittent, but under the case law, if it's sufficiently regular, permanent, and likely to continue, it's still a physical occupation case.
Well, I think it's on a continuum. I mean, I think a fact finder could say there has been you know, maybe not the rising to the level of physical taking, but there's a regulatory taking, but again, or nuisance taking, which I don't think fits in this case because I think
are you asserting a regulatory or nuisance taking?
No, we're asserting a physical taking claim.
Okay, so yeah. If you're asserting only a physical taking, why don't you think that the frequency regularity, well, maybe I'm misreading your brief. It seemed like you took some issue with the district court on that, and it seemed to me drawn directly from Spaeth.
Yeah, no, you're reading it correctly. My concern is the district court treated frequency as if that was one of the elements. And what frequency really is in a physical taking claim is it informs the permanence inquiry. It's part of deciding, is this really permanent? Because it can be intermittent. It doesn't have to be all the time. In these flooding cases, oftentimes they're not all the time.
Right, but frequency means, is it once every 30 years or is it once, you know, every week?
And we have an expert, you know, who will testify, and I think you can also say, yes, that's significant. That is evidence of permanence. That is evidence that it's going to happen again. It's certainly not evidence to the contrary. 3 times in 9 years isn't a reason to say, well, it's never going to happen again. We can say that as a matter of law. I think it opens a question, well, maybe that, you know, leads down the path of this being a permanent inquiry. And I think, or a permanent issue. And I think the city's own admissions on this issue, the reasonable inference is that they recognize there's a permanent problem here. They've been talking about this since 1982. This is not a new issue for them. They wouldn't be talking about building an outlet if there was no concern here, if this was just a one-off temporary thing that nobody saw coming, it was unprecedented rainfall, or there was a break in a pipe, and it's not going to happen again. Everybody, I think at least there's an inference, and this is on summary judgment, of course, that we are entitled to the benefit of that inference to say, there's a problem here. It's not going to go away, and we're entitled to be heard by a finder of fact to see, well, who's more credible?
What's the standard of law that the district court, if it went to trial, that the district court would be applying to determine whether there's a taking?
The standard would be whether it's interfered with the use, possession, or ability to dispose of the property.
Okay, so now you just vastly confuse me because now we moved into the airport type case, whatever, Alavizos or whatever it's called, and away from physical occupation.
Your Honor, I believe that those cases just look at the because it's not a physical intrusion, so it's not your exclusive possession of it. It's your use. It's your enjoyment. It's two of the three sticks. It's your use. You know, am I able to enjoy this property without interference? And how do I know that that's not you just being overly sensitive versus something's really happened here? So then you look at the third stick, which is diminution of value. Can I actually show a market decrease in value that basically shows that there's an objective belief among the community that, yeah, this is real. This is a significant impact.
Okay, but so that's what the district court should apply if this gets tried. And I know I'm going over, and the other side, I'll give more time. That's what the district court should apply if it goes back to trial. And you believe that you've created an issue of fact as to the diminution value?
Correct.
And that you've created an issue of fact as to?
The permanence of this condition.
Permanence of the condition.
It will inevitably recur.
Okay.
May I just?
Oh, of course.
Close?
Other
oh,
questions?
Absolutely.
For sure.
I just had one question on the switching over to the immunity, and perhaps you just want to think about this and address it on rebuttal. But I'm trying to understand when it comes to the your point about the decision to allow development in the area, and that not being protected by immunity, mm-hmm. because you believe that the testimony is too general. About ways. Mm-hmm. So I just want to understand, are you saying for the permits, I think there were 24 that were listed in your expert's report, that to be able to establish the immunity, the discretionary immunity or statutory immunity, you'd have to have testimony about the weighing for each one of those permits? I'm just trying to understand how detailed you think it should be. I'm fine to have you just address that on
rebuttal. No, go ahead.
On rebuttal.
Well, I think there's a comment from the city that cuts right through that, and it's in the record that this assistant city planner, when was asked about a new construction of a home built right on the shoreline of Huntington Pond in 2020, said, is there a hardcover restriction in this neighborhood? Because there are in other neighborhoods. Assistant city planner said, no, there's not. And we asked them, the city, in interrogatories, is there a hardcover restriction in this neighborhood? And there's not. So, unequivocally, there is no overarching policy
okay.
or ordinance.
Great.
May
okay.
I just...
Seeing no other questions... You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel, Elisa Hatlevig on behalf of the City of Minnetonka. The City of Minnetonka is here requesting this court affirm the lower court's decision. The district court properly granted the City of Minnetonka's motion for summary judgment dismissing appellants Shane and Sarah Feldhaus's petition and complaint. District court properly determined that the city did not take appellant's property, dismissing the petition for writ of mandamus and dismissing the attorney's fees claim. In addition, the district court correctly dismissed appellant's tort claims, finding the city was conduct was discretionary. On the petition for inverse condemnation, claiming a taking of the Feldhaus property, the district court looked at the specific facts of the case in determining no taking had occurred. In appellant's briefing and in their argument here today, they attempt to narrowly share the facts that are specific to the Feldhauses only. Those are only a small portion of the overall facts of this case. This is a classic case of an individual appellant looking at a micro view, where the city itself requires a macro view. The City of Minnetonka is 28 square miles, has 52,000 residents, 800 wetlands, and encompasses four watersheds. For the past 40 years, the city, as required by statute, provides a water resources management plan. They're currently on the fourth generation of that plan. It is part of a multi-tiered state framework for water resources, including the DNR, the Met Council, cities, counties, and watersheds. The cities must comply with these watershed plans of the state. These watershed water resources management plans do not set requirements for the city to follow, but goals and policies for the city and its resources, provides data and other background information, and outlines applicable regulations to guide the city in its decision making.
So, Council, it is all very, very helpful information, especially as to the immunity issue. I would like to start with the taking issue. See, you know, it's important to our consideration today, and I'm trying to view the district court's order generously, but I want to be, you know, pretty direct with you in terms of understanding what it is the district court was determining. When I read the analysis that I find at page 19 of the district court's decision, the analysis of the taking issue, right, that I see on page 19, I see it primarily a listing of the facts that favor a determination of no taking, where I do not see the facts or evidence offered by the appellants here that would have favored a taking. And because we're on summary judgment, I'm just trying to understand. And obviously you heard the argument. Appellants counsel thinks that they created genuine issues of material facts. So I'm very concerned about whether the district court applied the right standard for decision. So can you help me out? How do you see that taking issue?
And I think it is goes to this the overriding facts of the case related to.
But we don't do that on summary judgment. We don't do an overriding facts. We don't weigh facts.
But take the undisputed facts, and I think that the undisputed facts that were set forth fully in both in the brief set forward is that goes to this idea of that. Whether or not a taking has occurred, you need to take into account whether or not there has been the substantial diminution of value. And the court absolutely looks into that. And as to the
facts. They don't do that for a permanent physical taking, say, flooding of property, right? Well, I mean, they don't. A property owner where, just use my dam example because it's so clear, right? Where a dam is constructed and flooding is permanent on property, that owner doesn't have to prove a diminution in value. They may be entitled to damages, right? There's a damages trial later, but they don't have to prove that to prove the taking.
Well, I think there's a couple of different factors, Your Honor. I think we've talked a lot about Spaeth and Capone and Nelson, and those are all instructive. I would say Spaeth, Capone, and Nelson all arise from either a distinct construction event like a dam, which is Nelson, or a direct action of the government. In Spaeth, the city specifically designated that plaintiff's land as a holding pond. Then, after designating that land, private land, as a holding pond, they actively consulted and adopted elevations, turning it into a marshland. In Capone, similar thing happened, and then it was permanently flooded. In Nelson, the state built dams in 1940, and then that property, some of the land remained flooded all year round. So this component idea of all of the proper these cases, the properties were permanently flooded and it was wet all year round. This is not
forever, it wasn't. We do have a recognition in the case law that intermittent flooding may rise to a constitutional taking, again, based on the factors Judge Smith already alluded to. So I'm trying to, what I'd love to have is your understanding of how the district court viewed the evidence in this case. You say that it was undisputed, that the district court looked at all the undisputed facts, but there are disputed facts, right, about the effect of the flooding on this property, how long the flooding took place, whether it's going to recur, whether there's a permanent risk of flooding.
You asked counsel the question about those 3 years that there was flooding. 2019, there was water in the backyard for months. There was water in the backyards of countless houses in the city of Minnetonka, and that's all part of the record that was set forth before the court. That was the wettest year in the history, according to the Minnesota DNR. That was an extreme, extreme event, and that is also part of the record. So in 2017, which was considered less severe, as testified to by the Feldhauses, I believe Shane Feldhaus, and we cited in our brief on page 11, said it that they didn't even have interference with their use of the property in 2017. In 2014, I think it was, the record indicates it was a matter of weeks. And so those are what we know about their use of the property and how the waters affected them during those time periods. And that's all part of the record that was before the district court. As to the damages, I believe the Feldhauses testified that there was very little damages because there was water only in the backyard. Again, water never entered this house. Water got in the backyards as it did throughout. And there's a mistaken idea that the pumping that was done at Huntington was only done for the Feldhauses. That is incorrect. In 2019, the delay in the pumping in that, what you can see in the record, is that there is DNR-required permitting, and the city engineers had to make a decision because water has to go somewhere. They cannot just pump water. The city was inundated. And in 2019, when that water was pumped down, it was for the benefit of all the neighbors on Huntington Pond. Both the Feldhauses testified that other neighbors expressed concerns about their own properties because in 2019 was that wet. Other properties also had this, backyards that were wet, as well as swing sets underwater, as well as trees underwater. And that goes to the other portion of where the court looked at for this, the writ of mandamus. It has to be particular and specific to that person. So you take into account Spaeth, Capone, and Nelson, that was an individualized piece of property that was affected by the government's actions. Here, this writ of mandamus, and the reason the overriding undisputed facts matter is because the Feldhauses have this narrow idea of that this is just affecting them, when it's not true. In 2019, water was everywhere.
The effect on other landowners, I think, has a big impact in this case on your immunity argument. I don't see where that impacts the taking analysis.
I'm sorry, which part?
Sorry, when you turn to discuss the scope of the flooding on the city as a whole, and that the city had some difficult decisions to make about how to manage the water, how to manage many stormwater retention ponds, not just Huntington Pond. I appreciate all of those facts. It's well laid out in all of the briefing and recognized by the district court. And it probably does impact our analysis on the immunity issue. But I don't see how it affects our analysis on the taking issue. The issue is what happened to this particular property and whether it has, under the theory that the plaintiffs' appellants have offered in this case, does it amount constitutionally to a taking?
Understood, Your Honor. Yes, and I think that the idea, and they've cited even Loretto for their idea of a permanent taking. Well, Loretto involved the installation of cables. So going to the question, there was a question about severity, and they used Loretto saying a permanent taking doesn't have to be severe. Well, Loretto, there was cables actually installed on that property, so there was no question that there was a component of physical taking. Here, when we're looking at, and since 2019, there's been nothing in the record that has indicated they've had any issues since 2019, and we sit here in 2014. And 2019 was a specifically...
There's been no recognition of any issues. I mean, the city itself, at least in the documents that I read, which include the water management plans as well as other records, recognize that not only this pond, but many ponds throughout the city, in fact, do pose a flooding risk for the landowners that abut those ponds, right? So there is an ongoing recognition of the flooding risk, correct?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I meant there was nothing reported to the city that the Feld houses had any problems since 2019. As to your point,
I'm talking about no actual flooding on the property, but it is an ongoing state of their property, a condition of the property that they are face a flooding risk, as do many other properties in the city.
To the point of, that goes to that 1982 Water Research and Management Plan. And in that Water Research and Management Plan, it does state that it could cause flooding. Let's be clear, it is a speculative thing because they take into account what could happen. So that 1982 Water Research Management Plan took into account development, as plaintiffs have talked about as being part of the problem. They took into account that there would be 10 acres of developed area in making their assumptions when they did the modeling and the flood risk. Since that time, they've lowered that to 6.4. In their this question about the development related to...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, though. Can you help me locate what you're talking about in the legal framework? Are you saying, are we in taking issue still? And is it an issue of causation then? That the city didn't cause the... what? Locate that for me.
And it does get... the development does dovetail into the immunities too, because they've used it for... They use it for both their tort claims and their taking claims, mm-hmm. Okay? So in their taking claim, they are claiming that because the land was allowed to be developed, the city's issuance of permits to allow that development has created an increased risk of floods at their property, and therefore it's a taking. And they've also said that this issuance of permits, which has been found by the Minnesota Supreme Court as discretionary, also is causing their nuisance and trespass claims. So they have used it for both.
Okay, and then as for what you were just arguing, am I to take from that you think there's no genuine dispute of fact that the city did not cause the taking by virtue of that plan? Or what?
Correct. As to the development, they cite particularly related to the amount of development, they had their expert do their own analysis of that. And in that analysis, what they don't put in there, they indicate that there was about 17,900 square feet of development in the 501 drainage, which is the Huntington Pond area, claiming that this is something that is the reason this happened. They fail to acknowledge that the 501 Huntington Pond drainage area is 42.4 acres, which is 1.85 million square feet. That's on the Water Research and Management Plan, document 36, page 130. It's one of the tables. So that goes to this idea of that development that they're saying is so egregious. It also, they're indicating that there was no hardscape requirements. That is a misstatement of the record. Ms. Manchester and Mr. Olson testified about that their planning department takes those. The city engineer and public works are directly involved in the issuance of those permits, of course. That's planning department, and there are ordinances that are considered for those hardscape requirements. They're available publicly. You can read them to find out what, and so the idea that appellants are claiming that it wasn't provided to them, it's been provided to everyone in the city to review. The development that's been allowed, as testified to both Mr. Manchester and Mr. Olson, indicates that that development would not have changed the water runoff in those areas. The drainage patterns have not changed. So to the point of this development, and then going into the immunities, the issues and permits has never been, it's always been a discretionary function that's been allowed as well. Going briefly, since we talked a little bit about the diminution of value issue, it is the Spaeth case that indicates that a compensable taking has occurred when physical government action, which goes to this concern that they have about the permitting, causes a definite and measurable diminution of value of plaintiff's property and interferes with the current practical enjoyment of the property. As testified to the Feld houses, they had weeks in 2014, months in 2019, like many other people did, and now they're trying to go forward with this idea that this risk. I do point the court's attention to the sensitivity analysis from 2021 that does indicate there are 47 structures at risk. The same risk that there's a potential flooding that could happen to the Feld houses is also a risk at 47 other properties. The city does its best to manage all of that and does its best to make determinations and improvements to minimize impacts throughout the city. And the diminution, the court properly found that there was no evidence of diminution of value. Unless there's questions, I know my time is up.
No? Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for your argument. And then 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address some of the comments made by counsel for the city. The first was citing to Spaeth and Nelson. Counsel argues that in those cases, the flooding arose from specific acts from designations by the city. But we have facts. We have asserted credible facts in this case that the flooding is in part caused by acts of the city, the increased development. And I understand that counsel argues, well, it's insignificant relative to the area of the pond, but our expert says it's not insignificant. Our expert says it caused a material change, that 17,000 square feet means something. And ultimately, whether that is right or wrong is up to a trier of fact to hear that testimony and decide. That's not enough, and they can rebut that with their own expert, Bar Engineering, who can say, you know, here's this modeling. It shows it's really not significant at all. But I'd also point out in the history of these WRMPs, and council mentioned how they planned for this. Well, actually, in the Quetica report, our expert, the Feld House's expert, discovered that up until the what appears the 2021 sensitivity analysis, the city had been modeling that neighborhood, assuming a 12-inch outlet had in fact been installed. And when you take that out, that's what you get with the sensitivity analysis, which shows, no, actually, you have not understood the flooding risk, and it's much worse. That's what our expert is going to testify to, that it was underestimated for decades because they had mistakenly modeled it. And they reviewed the city's own data through discovery to come to that conclusion. And I think that this development issue, I mean, this is talked about in actual cases, the Chabot case, the Roach case. They specifically talk about instances where if the city had developed an area and as a result of that development, cast water onto these properties, that could give rise to liability. And there's an important point of law in Wilson v. Rahmacher where the court notes there is no reasonable use doctrine for floodwaters of a city, of a public body. They cannot cast their drainage waters onto private property in any amount. And if they have done that, then there's a liability, and that's different from a private landowner. A private landowner can do that, but a city cannot, or a public body cannot do that. I also note that, you know, the district court commented on this, and the city makes a big deal of this about how the house isn't flooded. But with all due respect, backyards are valuable real property. I mean, they just are. Every you know, you pay a lot of money, and these have value. It's inherent value. It's real value that means something to everybody. And I think that's it recognized in the law as being undeniable. The flooding, the pumping in 2014 and 2019, yes, that may have benefited more properties than just the Feld houses. And this dovetails with this argument that the city is making about, you know, there's problems everywhere. Well, first of all, in regard to a taking in particular, but I also think with regard to a tort claim and trespass and nuisance, you know, those properties need to stand on their own merits. They are not before this court. We are talking about what have the Feld houses experienced, what is their injury, and what are they dealing with. And so I don't see how it's a defense for the court, for the city to say, well, we have to manage a lot of property. And we can't be held accountable if we, you know, flood someone's property because we didn't do a good job here or there, or regardless if we did a good job. I mean, you have a de facto taking, like in the Cones case and the Brooks case, where the court recognizes if you do it, it really doesn't even matter. If you've actually appropriated this, we don't really care whether or not you meant to do it or you designated it. You did it. You own this property now. You're flooding it.
And certainly you make a good point as to the taking analysis, counsel, but as to the immunity analysis, the fact that the city has so many properties to manage, so many wetlands and pond areas to manage, does have an impact, right? I mean, a decision to pump or not to pump a particular property is a result of a discretionary decision, isn't it?
The pumping, absolutely. But this is like,
I read your brief as not arguing that, just to be
yeah, clear. And we're not, yeah. Okay. And I think that's an important point that came out in the Tengen case, a recent Tengen case, where the court there recognized the city of Edina was talking about the pumping and saying, we're talking about removing the water. And the court said, well, yeah, but there's also the conduct that got the water there in the first place. What about that? Where did you exercise discretion that you really couldn't prevent that from happening? And I understand the city has testified in a conclusory fashion, well, we did consider that, but there's no evidence of that. You know, the Nussbaum v. Blue Earth County case is really helpful to see where, even if there's a policy in place, the person who is executing that policy on operational level, they have to show that they thought about that policy. So if there was evidence in the record beyond just their testimony saying, yeah, we thought about that, but we're not going to manage it in this area because it's economically infeasible for us or whatever it might be, then they'd have an immunity defense. But there's no evidence they considered it at all, ever.
Considered what?
The risk of hardcover, the impact that hardcover has on these properties. And to date, they do not have a hardcover ordinance.
Do we have evidence in the record from the planning department, as to what factors they considered before they issued the permits? That, we do have this list of permits that your expert reviewed and indicated as one reason why there had been an increase in water drainage into the pond. Do we have evidence in the record about the considerations that the planning department made in granting those permits?
Other than the permits themselves, we have that. And I asked the 3002 deposition to ask the city representatives, what do you consider in granting these permits? And their response was this conclusory fashion of, well, we do consider these things, but there's no actual evidence of that other than that testimony.
All right, I have one question.
Okay.
It's a little left field, maybe you don't have an answer for it. But again, trying to figure out what is the nature of the taking at your city. Mm-hmm. And one of your things was talking about the right to dispose of the property later and a diminution in value because blah, blah, blah. What if the city decided to add the outlets and it resulted in what some of the neighbors were concerned about, a low, stinky pond that had no wildlife anymore? Would that be a potential taking from your client and the neighbors if, in fact, the pond became smelly and so on? Then are we into not a physical occupation, but the enjoyment?
Yes.
That could be a taking.
That'd be the nature, yes, Your Honor, I believe so. A nuisance-type taking or regulatory taking of, now my property smells all the time because you lowered the water level. That would be a different category.
And your taking theory seems to be both, to me, in a way, physical occupation as well as use and enjoyment, or you equate them, or they're the same in your case, or they're different. I don't know, but you're asserting both.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. I think the use and enjoyment is one of those bundles of sticks, and then the physical taking, if you physically take my property, you've definitely taken those sticks.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any more questions? Okay. Thank you both very
Thank
much
you,
for
honors.
The briefing, for your arguments. We appreciate it. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time period. Okay.